Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Music Review. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about music from such sources as the New York Times, the News and Observer, the Week Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Entertainment Weekly. Music Review is designed to provide the latest coverage of classical, folk, jazz, blues, rock, country, and pop music news. But first, these musical trivia questions. Today's musical trivia questions come to us from the websites QURA.com and stylist.co.uk. Question number one. What is the musical origin of the word tragedy? Is it A, Verdi's opera based on Shakespeare's Macbeth? Is it B, Greek word for song of the male goat? Is it C, Wagner's opera The Flying Dutchman? Or D, The Marriage of Figaro by Mozart? Origins of the word tragedy. And question number two, which 1960s rock band was inspired by the phrase, go down like a lead balloon? Was that A, Jefferson Airplane, B, Led Zeppelin, C, The Rolling Stones, or D, The Grateful Dead? Go down like a lead balloon. Which one was it? The answers to these two important musical trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. Our transitions come to us from the website onthisday.com, and today, quote-unquote, is the weekend of July 27th. Well, it was on this day, back in 1750, that Johann Sebastian Bach died after an unsuccessful eye operation. 1750. And it was 85 years ago today, 1933, that the first singing telegram was sent. It was given to Rudy Valley on his 32nd birthday, 1933.
But I do know that we'll meet again some sunny day. So, honey, keep on smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away.
Johnny Cash performing We'll Meet Again introduces our country music news. It's an article titled My Favorite Beatles Song, and is written by Roseanne Cash on her decades-long relationship with a poignant pop song about romantic betrayal and the shock of recognition. This is published in AARP, the magazine, July 2018.
Don't know where, but I know. Sunny day.
A handful of words, expertly woven into a fierce melody, reveal a story of crushing disappointment framed by the strained and aching timbre of John Lennon's voice. I heard No Reply for the first time when I was 10 years old. I got the album Beatles 65 and played it on my little record player in my bedroom in Casitas Springs, California. It's a song about betrayal. He saw her walk in the door with another man. He's been watching her, but it's not creepy, it's heartbreaking. He is so full of desire that he can't help himself. The shock of finding that you aren't loved is the deepest cut. My dad was the singer Johnny Cash. In Casitas Springs in 1965, I was in my parents' bedroom looking at my mother's clothes and trailing my fingers over the beautiful things in her long closet. The white chiffon and gold sequin cocktail dress, the tweed suits, the silk blouses and capri pants, when the phone rang. I picked up the receiver at the same time as my mother, Vivian, who was in the kitchen. She didn't hear me. My father's voice was on the other end. They spoke for a few minutes, and then my father hung up. I don't remember their words, but I remember the devastation I felt. Cracks in the foundation of their marriage were clear. I couldn't hang up. I sat and listened to the dial tone for several minutes until I heard my mother walking down the hall, and then I quickly put the receiver back in the cradle. She walked into the room and acted as if nothing had happened. The subtext of my own life was the same as the one in the song, No Reply, one of disappointment and longing. I knocked on my parents' door, and no one answered, just like the song. When I came to your door, no reply. Perhaps it's only now, a half century later, that I realize why those eight words held such power. They embodied shame and desperation, and the shame of desperation. Why is there no reply from the woman who apparently once loved the singer? Why is there no reply from my parents? There is a terrible reason. Someone else is in the house. Romantic betrayal is a sophisticated concept for a 10-year-old. What do promises mean if they're nullified by sexual restlessness? This was beyond my understanding in 1965. Betrayal was incomprehensible, but thrilling and dark. There was a roiling inner world behind the stoic facades, and that world could be the doorway to art and music. It might be a door I could walk through. But No Reply is a song, not a short story or a cautionary tale. The heartbreak in the words isn't separate from the infrastructure of the lyric form, nor is it detached from the melody, and even harder to pull off, it is of a piece with Lennon's vocal performance. Ray Charles said that singers were better at age 50 than at 25 because a whole life showed up in the voice at 50. But John Lennon was 9 days shy of turning 24 when he recorded No Reply. Just this once, Ray was wrong. Lennon's howl that he nearly died is the denouement of the emotional arc. It has the stark intensity of Hank Williams' line, "I'm so lonesome I could cry," or my dad singing, "I walk the line," plaintive to the point of transcending the meaning. The life that shows up in the voice is made of choices. Even though the song is credited to Lennon and Paul McCartney, it's widely accepted that John wrote the song. Shortly before he died in 1980, Lennon said in an interview, "I had that image of walking down the street and seeing her silhouetted in the window and not answering the phone, although I never called a girl on the phone in my life, because phones weren't part of the English child's life." Lennon created characters to fit an existing emotional template. Some might say there is no great truth in No Reply, that it's just a catchy pop tune, cleverly arranged, sung by a riveting vocalist. Oh yes, that as well. I've returned to No Reply in every stage of my life. You develop a relationship with the song over a half a century. The early years are flush with passion, strong territoriality, and a slight confusion. The middle years are a little numb, and there isn't a lot of gratitude. The hallmark of my current phase is benevolent agitation and love. I love the girl who cheated. I love the boy who had his heart broken. I love myself, as I was on both sides of the door. The sequence of events is switched, however. I nearly died, then I saw the light. But I'm still reaching for No Reply. And in classical music news, we have this article titled, "Yes, the composer of an 8-hour concert titled Sleep really wants people to snooze through it." This is written by Kelly Sky Fodrosky on the 17th of July, 2018, published in Orange County Register. Composer Max Richter doesn't want a boisterous standing ovation or to hear loud cheers during the live performance of his album, Sleep. He prefers the quiet sounds of breathing or even a bit of snoring. Richter will bring Sleep, an 8-hour classical music experience, to Grand Park in downtown Los Angeles on July 27 and 28. However, this isn't a standard concert. Guests are issued cots instead of seats, are encouraged to wear loose-fitting and comfortable clothing, and are expected to fall asleep as the overnight performance runs from 10 p.m. to 6:30 a.m. There is almost always some snoring, Richter said during a recent phone interview. I get sort of a weird sense of validation when I hear it. That makes me really happy. Actually, it's quite comforting as well, almost like having a cat purring. Richter was born in West Germany and currently resides in London, England. He has written and composed music for theatrical performances, operas, ballets, and feature films. But Sleep is a body of work based on the neuroscience of sleep, on which Richter consulted neuroscientist David Eagleman about how the brain functions during sleep. The origins of sleep really go back to the lullaby tradition, Richter explained. Music and sleep have been connected throughout the human civilization, and it's really universal. I guess the neuroscience sheds a kind of light on that from a scientific standpoint, as people have done research to show that certain kinds of sounds can be used to support and promote the kinds of healthy aspects of sleeping, like learning and memory consolidation. There's a lot of interesting research to it, and I wanted to make a piece which made that connection between sleeping and music, and also a piece which could work as a holiday, really, from our data-saturated world. Around the world, we are very much sort of always on now, he said. We have this 24/7 screen-based culture, and sleep is kind of eroded by that, and we find it increasingly difficult to switch off. One of the aspects of the piece is to sort of make an environment in which supports that kind of switching off and stepping off that hamster wheel for a moment. Richter performs at the piano live with some 215 pages of sheet music for the duration of the show and is accompanied by musicians and singers that played on the Sleep album. Sleep has been performed live in New York City, at the South by Southwest Festival in Austin, Texas, as well as in London and Berlin and in Sydney. However, Sleep will be presented for the very first time outdoors when it comes to L.A. For the first 7 hours of the performance, the music is pretty low frequency, and as the event comes to an end and the sun begins to rise, the music picks up and the frequency gets a little higher in the final hour, much like those non-jarring, pleasant-sounding sunlight alarm clocks. One of the things that's interesting is that you get a community forming at the gig, he noted. Sleeping is normally a private and intimate thing, and you're sleeping now with hundreds of strangers overnight, and it's like you've gone through something together. It's almost like a little campfire thing, and in the morning, they all get up and go breakfasting. So not just classical music, but a little bit of music research and technology in that article. And in jazz music news, we have this article entitled The Devil's Music, 1920s Jazz. This is published in PBS.com. When the new sound of jazz first spread across America in the early 20th century, it left delight and controversy in its wake. The more popular it became, the more the liberating and sensuous music was criticized by everyone and everything from car maker Henry Ford to publications like the Ladies' Home Journal and the New York Times. Yet jazz survived. What was it about the music that offended so many people, and how did jazz finally gain widespread acceptance? Jazz was different because it broke the rules, musical and social. It featured improvisation over traditional structure, performer over composer, and Black American experience over conventional white sensibilities. Undercurrents of racism bore strongly upon the opposition to jazz, which was seen as barbaric and immoral. Before jazz emerged, many music educators worried that jazz would destroy young people's interest in classical music, tried to convince the public that European classical music was the only, quote-unquote, good music. But the music played on. New Orleans became the first center of jazz, with honky-tonk clubs popping up all over Storyville, the city's red light district. Because Black musicians were not allowed to play in quote-unquote proper establishments like their white counterparts, jazz became associated with brothels and other less reputable venues. The U.S. Navy in 1917, fearing for the health and safety of sailors who frequented the jazz clubs, shut them down. The same year, the original Dixieland Jazz Band, an all-white group from New Orleans, cut the first jazz record, bringing the music to a national audience and opening the door for sound-alike white bands to cash in on the jazz scene. As jazz's popularity grew, so did campaigns to censor the quote-unquote devil's music. Early detractors like Thomas Edison, inventor of the phonograph, ridiculed jazz, saying it sounded better played backwards. A Cincinnati home for expectant mothers won an injunction to prevent construction of a neighboring theater where jazz would be played, convincing a court that the music was dangerous to fetuses. By the end of the 1920s, at least 60 communities across the nation had enacted laws prohibiting jazz in public dance halls. While the critics and the courts failed to silence jazz, the growing demand for labor following World War I managed to expand its influence. Hundreds of thousands of African Americans fled the South to find work in industrial cities to the North during the teens and early 20s. White youth from all social classes were drawn to jazz and the seductive new dances that went along with it. With the help of the Monkey Glide, the Turkey Trot, and the Charleston, they were moved by the music, figuratively and literally. Jazz recordings allowed the music to reach beyond the nightclubs. New York radio and recording companies began to dominate the music industry, replacing Chicago as the center of jazz. The 1920s also marked the self-coronation of the quote-unquote king of jazz, a white bandleader named Paul Whiteman. Although many blacks and whites criticized Whiteman for co-opting and sanitizing jazz, his recordings, which linked his syncopated sound to European symphonic music, sold millions. While Whiteman was getting rich, Louis Armstrong, the true jazz genius, arrived in New York City, where he played to a smaller but loyal audience of fans and fellow musicians who understood that they were witnessing a new revolution in jazz. Armstrong soon emerged as a star attraction, achieving popular success on the New York stage. Another jazz great of the century, composer and bandleader Duke Ellington, created a sensation when he toured England in 1933. By the time Ellington hit the scene, classical musicians and music critics alike were analyzing jazz and declaring it a serious art form.
Sitting in the railway station, got a ticket for my destination. On a tour of one-night stands, my suitcase and guitar in hand, and every stop is neatly planned for a poet and a one-man band. Homeward Bound.
Simon and Garfunkel's Homeward Bound introduces our rock and pop music article entitled Swan Songs, and this is published in Entertainment Weekly this summer preview 2018. Farewell tour skepticism is understandable, but these folks really seem to mean it. See them while you can, until maybe you can again. First of all, Paul Simon. Expect solo hits and Simon and Garfunkel classics on his Homeward Bound jaunt through September 22nd in the U.S. Anita Baker, the R&B queen, is giving it the best that she's got one last time. Only a handful of dates have been announced so far. Ozzy Osbourne, the title says it all, no more tours, two. Yes, two. The first was in 92. Board the Crazy Train in the U.S. on August the 30th. Lynyrd Skynyrd, the Southern Rockers are currently giving Freebird a final workout on the last of the Street Survivors tour. And then there's Slayer, the metal legend's final stand, boasts a career-spanning set list and a U.S. end date of August 26th as of press time.
On n'a pas besoin de chercher si loin. Non, on n'a pas besoin de chercher si loin. On trouve ce qu'on veut à côté de chez soi. Des sourires, des aveux.
Paris Combos. On n'est pas besoin introduces our local music news. We have a couple of concerts upcoming. North Carolina Museum of Art in Raleigh. And go to pinecone.org or ncma.org for additional information. First of all, we have Jake Shimabukuro with Kishibashi on August the 3rd at 7:30 p.m. at the Art Museum. Seattle-born Kaoru Ishibashi studied film scoring at Berklee College of Music. Then he toured with Regina Spektor, Sondre Lerche, and Dierhoff. Soon he was layering Caribbean beatboxing and electronic looping with classical string arrangements. NPR Music named him 2012's Best New Artist of the Year. And Jake Shimabukuro, heralded as the best living ukulele player in the world, the ukulele, with its humble four strings and modest two-octave range, is an instrument limited only by the imagination and creativity of the person playing it, according to Jake Shimabukuro. Since 2001, Bette Midler, Cyndi Lauper, Jack Johnson, Ziggy Marley, Bella Fleck, and others have pursued collaborations with Shimabukuro, and Eddie Vedder honors him for re-inspiring his own ukulele projects. And then coming up on August the 4th at 8 p.m. at the museum, we have Paris Combo, the group playing in the background right now. Six albums and two decades spent crisscrossing the globe have enabled Paris Combo to create a unique cosmopolitan sound, establishing the band as one of the most piquant, intriguing groups of the international music scene. Fronted by the charismatic vocals of Belle du Berry, the combo has struck a chord with critics and audiences alike with their fun-loving mix of swinging gypsy jazz, cabaret, French pop, and Latino and Middle Eastern rhythms. So how'd you do on today's musical trivia questions? Well, the answer to our first question, what is the musical origin of the word tragedy? Is it Verdi's opera based on Shakespeare's Macbeth? Or is it B, Greek word for Song of the Male Goat? Is it C, Wagner's opera, The Flying Dutchman? Or D, The Marriage of Figaro by Mozart? And the correct answer is... Answer B. The word tragedy is from the Greek word for Song of the Male Goat. As noted in an article titled What Words Have the Most Interesting Origins by Huzafe Khan published in Quora.com on the 24th of January, 2017, tragedy is defined as an event causing great suffering and destruction. Well, the Greeks are at it again. Tragedy comes from the Greek word tragodia, which means song of the male goat. Ancient Greeks thought goats were crazy, sad. Apparently, also, they used to have performances where a chorus would dance around a goat and then ritually sacrifice him, which is pretty damn sad if you think about it. And the answer to our second question, which 1960s rock band was inspired by the phrase, go down like a lead balloon? Was it A, Jefferson Airplane, B, Led Zeppelin, C, the Rolling Stones, or D, Grateful Dead? Correct answer, answer B, Led Zeppelin. As noted in a 9/11 article titled Everyday Sayings Explained, published in Stylist, .co.uk, the U.S. version of the phrase go over like a lead balloon first appeared in a mom-and-pop cartoon in several newspapers in 1924. It then fell out of use until after World War II and was said to inspire a certain heavy metal band to name themselves Led Zeppelin. The metal part of their name is spelled L-E-D rather than L-E-A-D, and a Zeppelin is a type of rigid airship named after the German Count Ferdinand von Zeppelin, who pioneered rigid airship development at the beginning of the 20th century. By the mid-1914s, by the way, Zeppelins had carried over 10,000 fare-paying passengers on over 1,500 flights. During World War I, the German military made extensive use of Zeppelins as bombers and scouts, killing over 500 people in bombing raids in Britain. Those innocent civilians deserve a quote-unquote stairway to heaven. So let's close out today's program with the heavy metal rock band Led Zeppelin performing their song of the same name, Stairway to Heaven.
All that glitters is gold, and she's buying the stairway to heaven.
Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Music Review. And as we leave you, remember these words. Kindness is a language which blind people see and deaf people hear. Be sure to tune in at the same time next week. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Content of this program intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Music Review is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast in the TRRS website, TriangleReadingService.org. Now, if you have a suggestion for music to feature on this program, please leave a message for me, Randy Thompson at 919-832-5138. So long, until next time.
All of our thoughts of this fear.